lonely vegetarian sweep you off your feet like a maid marrying, having fun like a seminary in a wait. You say you're a happy Unitarian laughing in the wind like an old Bulgarian. Hey, by the way, are you a librarian? Oh, how sweet.
Hello and welcome to the Mount Kisco Public Library Podcast. Today we're very privileged to speak with Elizabeth Wien, whose latest book, Codename Verity, has been flying off our library shelves and is generating a huge amount of buzz all around the world. To set the mood for our conversation, I'd like to play some music directly from the book. So, here is Felix Mendelssohn's Hebrides Overture, Opus 26, Fingal's Cave.
Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi there.
I'm Deirdre. This is my sister, Mary, and she's a huge fan of The Winter Prince.
Oh, wow.
My colleague, Maria, unfortunately couldn't be here, but we have some questions from her, and there's a lot of people here reading your book.
That is very good to know, because I have no sense of who's reading it, who's taking it out, whether or not teens are actually getting hold of it and enjoying it.
I think you might be really pleased to know I've been talking it up to a bunch of teens, boys and girls, and the boys hear about the plot. Oh, it's these two girls, and one's in the Secret Service and the other's a pilot, and they're like, that's cool.
Well, that's great. I would have thought it would be a harder sell to boys than to girls.
Yeah, possibly because of the girl factor, yeah. But the story itself is so great. So, yeah, no problem, I don't think.
Good.
Okay, so Mary, would you like to start?
I guess so. I was really struck by The Winter Prince, and one of the things that fascinates me is the main character, the archer. And so you go very deeply into character and their motivations and force them to examine their motivations, and I'm wondering how you start developing a character like that. And what got you interested in telling stories like this?
It's kind of just part of me, and I don't think I can say why I started telling this kind of story. It is clearly something I have been doing all my life. When I started working on Codename Verity, I dug out the, I want to put in quotes, illustrations that I did for this epic World War II story that I had made up when I was about 12 years old.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't actually write any of this down. There's a total of about 200 words, various little bits and pieces. But the only pieces that do exist are the conversation between the interrogator and the heroine, who is this, you know, lovely 16-year-old girl. And it's the same kind of relationship. It's the exact same relationship that you get between the characters in The Winter Prince. It's the same kind of relationship that you get in some of my more recent novels between Telemachus and Abraha, the Imyar. And it's this kind of controversial thing where there's a person in a position of power, and then there's a person who is evidently helpless, and yet they are engaged in this kind of mental battle against each other. And it's just something that my brain, for some reason or other, is really engaged by. And all my stories are like that. You'd be able to produce anything else except this kind of adversarial relationship between characters. So,
well, it makes for great drama. But the other thing that fascinated me about that book in particular, I wanted to know a little bit about the research, because one of the things I loved in The Winter Prince, and I think it's also true in the Ethiopian novels, is the reality of the setting and of the culture. And you do that in Codename Verity also. So how did you research this?
And the knitting.
What was that?
No, I just said the knitting. We were examining knitting patterns.
That came later. The initial research for Codename Verity was actually done for a short story called Something Worth Doing, which is in Harvard Soaring. And it is, as you may know, a story about a girl who disguises herself as her dead brother and becomes a fighter pilot during the Battle of Britain. So I'd actually done an intense amount of research on the Battle of Britain for that story. And it was in writing that story that I discovered the air transport auxiliary. So I knew now that there were women flying planes in Britain during the war, and I was just interested in it. So I guess the way I start researching anything is I find a few books. I do it the old-fashioned way.
That's good.
I read books, and actually I get books out of the library, and then when I realize that I've renewed them, you know, four times, and they're full of post-it notes, I buy my own. And it seems like for every book, there are a couple of core research texts that I just refer to again and again. For the Ethiopian books, it's the one that's quoted in the notes for A Coalition of Lions. And in fact, I have it here because I'm writing ancient city travel entry for BBC History magazine.
Oh, and cool.
And it's this book, which is called Aksum, not surprisingly, An African Civilization of Late Antiquity by Stuart Munro Hay. And it's like my Bible. It just has everything. I mean, there's tons of other research that I did as well, but this is the one that has everything right there in one place. And for Codename Verity, the Air Transport Auxiliary, the number one book that I used was, it's also referenced in the back, The History of the ATA by Lettice Curtis, which is like a really dry read. Full of information. It's got all the information you want. And it's actually got some really interesting and kind of jaw-dropping stories in it, but you have to dig for them. It's a heavy, heavy book. And then for the Special Operations Executive, I guess the number one thing I referred to was The Women Who Lived for Danger. Again, there are a ton of other books that I've read, but these were the major ones. And then, you know, you go to museums and you do trawling online. Details. The internet is a wonderful, wonderful place to pick up details. And I think I found out about the Jewish prescription forms by accident, because I was just looking for a contemporary French prescription form to see what it would look like. And I turned up a picture of this prescription form with the Star of David on it and a little caveat saying, you know, I don't remember what it said exactly, but it was something like, this form may only be used by a Jewish doctor for Jewish patients. So little details like that are absolutely wonderful when they turn up, and the internet is a place to find them very easily, unfortunately, or fortunately. It's certainly easier doing this kind of research than it was doing research for The Winter Prince, which was extremely haphazard, I have to say. I'm more practiced at it now.
Although serendipity is good. We love that as librarians. That's one of the reasons why a physical library is such a great place, just the accidental discovery of stuff. But that brings me to one of my questions that I'm always asking. Did you always want to be a writer?
I always wanted to be a writer, but I didn't draft Codename Verity when I was 12. I just did pictures for it.
Oh, that's so cool.
I just sat there doodling little pictures for it. And actually, the orange sweater, this was a joke from that book. My heroine always had an orange sweater, and it was because when I started doodling these pictures, I had in my desk an orange pencil. I had like a normal pencil and an orange pencil. So her skirt was gray and her sweater was orange. I dug these pictures out and was looking through them and was trying to reconstruct the story, which was really, really hard because there was no text to tell you what was going on, and I didn't remember people's names, and I didn't remember really a lot of the stranger plot details. You know, there's a picture of this couple in their bathing suits racing to the edge of this seaside cliff with a Nazi jeep and people jumping out of the jeep running after them with guns. What's going on there?
Oh my.
It's not the story of Codename Verity. The relationship at its heart between the interrogator and the girl clearly is echoed in Codename Verity. But the rest of the complicated plot, I can't really tell you anything about because I've forgotten it. But I did always want to be a writer, pretty much from the time I started reading chapter books. And the first one that I read from start to finish was Ellen Tebbutt's by Beverly Cleary.
Uh-huh.
I think I closed this book and I was like, right, I was seven. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to write books like this. And I tell someone the story and they go, and do you write books? Have you ever written a book like Ellen Tebbutt's? I was like, well, no, not exactly like that. But
well, no.
That was where I got started. I just really, really enjoyed reading and thought, I want to do this too. My earliest attempts, again, at about seven, were along the lines of the Hardy Boys. I was really into the Hardy Boys, not so much Nancy Drew. The Hardy Boys got into more dire situations. I still have a tendency to put my own characters into dire situations.
And yourself as well. I understand that you yourself fly planes, yes?
I try really hard not to put myself in dire situations. Everybody says, oh, so you know, your own experience shows so much in this book. I'm like, well, I've never actually been fired on while I was flying. And I've never, thank God, had to crash land a plane. So a little bit of my own experience. The part where Maddie is flying over Scotland and mm-hmm. it's snowing in the cockpit, mm-hmm. that is based on my own experience.
Wow.
But, yeah, I mean, that's dire in a different way. That's the point at which you just think, what am I doing here? And I have actually taken off into weather that was so foul where I thought, I'm not doing this, and I just turned straight around and landed again.
Very wise. We would hate to lose you.
It can be scary, but actually so much of learning to fly is learning how to deal with emergencies. It kind of came as a surprise to me when I did a really long cross-country trip one time. And so I thought, right, okay, here I am. I'm set up flying straight and level. What do I do now? And it's like, well, I don't have to pretend I'm stalling. I don't have to pretend I've got an engine fire. Oh, wow, I just fly the plane and look out the window. And actually, that's the fun part, is just flying a plane and looking out the window. So you spend a lot of time in your training learning what to do in emergencies. And it gives you the impression that it's a really, really scary thing to do. But actually, when you're flying a plane, it's quite nice, really.
So now I have to ask, have you seen the green flash from the air?
No. No, I've not seen the green flash ever. And I have nearly blinded myself watching for it. I got my two kids, who are now 12 and 15, but were a bit younger than that, 2 years ago, they got so fed up with me trying to, you know, drive to high places at sunset looking for the green flash that I've not seen it. I've seen the Northern Lights, which is another of my life goals.
That's wonderful. They were in this area, and yeah. My brother managed to see them, and I didn't. So.
Yeah. They're here. Yeah. People I know have seen them actually walking down the street in Perth during a time when I was, I don't know, making supper or something. Mm-hmm. So I keep missing them. They're not common here.
Okay, so I wondered whether you knew that Fly the Plane, Maddie has become a sort of battle cry all over the place. And
yeah,
it's a slogan. Yeah?
I love that. I've seen people tweeting it to each other. Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. And I do see people's blog reviews, and I see people saying to themselves, whenever I get stuck in my writing, I tell myself, fly the plane, Maddie. And I think, wow, that is so neat, you know, because clearly there are people out there who are inspired by stuff I've written, and that's, right. You know, extremely gratifying. So.
And by your characters, they're so real and vivid. You know, do you feel actually proud of your characters?
Do you mean proud of having created them or proud of them?
Of them.
Yes, definitely. I mean, they're, you know, real people in my head.
Yeah.
Yeah. While I was writing the Verity section, was really the easiest thing I've ever done in my life. That voice just came really naturally.
Really?
Yeah.
It's so complicated, though.
Well, but you have to kind of separate the voice from the structure, because the structure is complicated, but just her natural voice was very, very easy for me to write. The structure is complicated, and I had to kind of go back and draw myself timelines, and because I wasn't dating anything at first, I got so confused about what was going on when. But in any case, that part was easy for me to write just in terms of, you know, sort of spewing it out. It did need structuring, but the writing was easy. Writing Maddie's section was actually a lot more difficult, partly because I didn't want her to sound like Queenie. I didn't want her to sound exactly the same, and she wasn't as educated, and she didn't have the same literary background, so I couldn't make the same references, and I had to be very, very cautious. And also, I found that, you know, one of the things that comes naturally to me as a writer is putting in what I call hoop-to-doodle, which is actually a term John Steinbeck uses for flowery prose that kind of connects passages. Mm-hmm. And I had to stop myself doing it because that's just not the way Maddie would write. And actually, the way I found myself getting around it was any time she needed a metaphor or a simile, I would put in something to do with aircraft or engines, which actually worked quite well because it's kind of how she thinks.
Yeah.
But it was hard work putting that section together, and I was concentrating a lot on getting her voice right. And as the various little incidents were coming out and the whole thing was coming into shape, I would find myself exclaiming aloud, "Maddie, you're so nice!" Because I've never made up a character as nice as Maddie Brodat. Just astonished me as she was, you know, doing her thing, how stalwart a person she was, and really how kind she is.
Yes, very kind. And that's the crux of the story, isn't it? Her kindness, which comes from her great love of her friend. And that's another thing that we love about the book, that it's a book that centers on friendship, without maybe that element of romance. And that can be very refreshing. Like in Sarah Rees Brennan, the focus of the first book is love between brothers. And that's not something that you read about a lot, you know?
Yeah.
Love between friends is another one that's not really...
I did plan that. I had a bunch of beta readers who were really into it and kind of got it in serial form, you know, 30-page chunks at a time. And I'm hanging. You can just imagine the points at which you'd be left hanging. And when we were finished, we were all going, this is a story about friends. There aren't any out there. There aren't any stories about female friends and best friends. And we were trying to come up with them. And we kept kind of coming back to Anne of Green Gables. But it was written a while ago, you know. So Ellen Tibbetts, of course.
Yeah. I loved Ellen Tibbetts when I was 9. One of my favorite books.
Yeah, so the friendship, I almost want to say I didn't do it on purpose. I came up with the plot before I came up with the characters or their history. And very technically, in order to make the plot work, I had to present them as best friends, and I had to create that history for them and show how much they cared about each other. Otherwise, the whole thing wasn't going to work. But actually, as I was doing that, I realized that I had this chance to just celebrate all my friends and how wonderful it is to have a friendship like that. So, yeah, it kind of came from the heart, that part of it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's, I think, why it works so, so well. And even those of us like me who are saying, this book isn't going to make me cry. I can get through it. I'm tough. It does. It does. It's very moving.
Now, I think I'm going to jump in and ask one of Maria's
questions that she always asks authors. She always likes to know what you're reading right now.
Oh, okay. Look, I have it right here next to me.
Okay.
This is a reread. It is The Life of My Choice by Wilfred Thesiger, who was the first British child, I think he was the first white child, born in Ethiopia in 1910. Mm. And it's more or less his autobiography. And I'm reading it because I'm kind of thinking of setting another story in Ethiopia, but a more recent story.
Mm.
So cool. So that's reread, and it's kind of intense. The other thing I'm in the middle of is A La Carte by Tanita Davis, which is her first book. Her most recent book is about a pair of twins whose father is transgender. She's also written a book called Mare's War, which is about the only black women's regiment sent to Europe during the Second World War, which is a really,
that's
really great
fascinating
book. Mm-hmm. So I'm a fan of Tanita Davis.
I think that I'll ask another kind of Maria question, and something that young readers often wonder too, and that's, how do you come up with the names of the characters? And in your case, the names of the planes are real, aren't they? How in the world did they come up with those?
Yeah, I don't know how they named the planes. The names of the planes are all real. There's a long story about how they named the Spitfire. They wanted to call it something really boring, like the jellyfish or something. I'm making that up, but it was something equally wet. The names of the planes are all real. The names of the characters, I really enjoy naming my characters. And actually, I had a bunch of kind of working names for Maddie before I finally came up with her name. And I asked my husband to suggest some early 20th century, very English-sounding names, and he immediately suggested Elizabeth and Margaret, which of course were the names of the princesses. So Maddie is actually older than Princess Margaret, so she can't have been named after her, but it was already a popular English name. And I got Maddie from Madge, which is another name, Margaret. So Maddie's not a common nickname, and I'm not sure if it's ever been a nickname for Margaret, but it's hers. And Brodat is actually my paternal grandmother's maiden name, and I chose it because it was a safe bet for her heritage, because that's what my grandmother's heritage is. But I changed the spelling of it a little, but it pleased me to be able to use that. And actually, my only surviving close relatives on my father's side as my father's older sister, and she was absolutely delighted that I had done that. Julie comes from Julia Flight.
Oh, in Brideshead.
Yeah. Because again, I was just trying to think, okay, we need an upper class name from that period.
Right. That Julie shares your Julie's characteristics of being delicate looking and beautiful, but really tough. So.
Yeah. Who else do we have? Dimpna. Haha, there is someone in our past who is connected with Flight whose name is Dimpna, and I won't really say more than that. It just seems like a wonderfully silly and kind of unusual name. And her surname, Withenshaw, is the name of an area of South Manchester. So, yeah, I like kind of putting these things together, you know, a name that's a little bit of a joke, inside joke, and something that also is quite plausible within the framework of the book. Ava Seiler is another little bit of a joke. There's Ava Braun, and, you know, you have this sort of association.
Right.
But Seiler, which she says is the name of her school, is actually an old name for the girls' section of the school I went to, which hasn't existed for a long time. But technically, it's the name of my school. And I have actually been caught out on this by one or two classmates. What? Seiler's the name of her school. Right.
One of my questions, when I was reading your books, I was very struck by the complexity of the characters and by the language, and it actually reminded me, especially Verity, a little bit of William Golding. And I was wondering who your literary influences were.
Huh. Well, that's interesting. I wouldn't have said that Golding was, although I admire him quite a bit, and I can see why you would say that. Certainly for my previous books, Alan Garner.
Yeah, I can see that.
Huh. Yeah. And as a student and on into my 20s, also Ursula Le Guin. So these were people that I really, really admired. More recently, I am a huge fan of Anne Morrow Lindbergh. Her diaries are absolutely fascinating, and some of her nonfiction about flying during the 30s, I just think is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And she certainly has influenced me as an adult. And she's influenced me in the last, 10 years. Before that, I would hark back to people like Alan Garner, Ursula Le Guin, and Dorothy Sayers.
I was just about to ask about Dorothy Sayers. It's very funny. She came up in our last podcast because she was also an influence on Kristen Cashore. But we know that you're a change ringer. Robin McKinley is also a change ringer, and of course Dorothy Sayers. And this to me got to your writing because it's so complicated. And we wondered if you, when you write, are you a puzzle maker, or are you a person who knows the whole arc before you start?
I'm not one of these sort of code-breaking brains. I'm more of a visual artist, maybe.
Oh.
I'm not very good at design, at code anyway, although I did manage to decode the end papers of Redshift by Alan Garner on my own. So maybe I'm not giving myself enough credit. The change ringing, there are different ways of remembering the changes. And, you know, Dorothy Sayers in The Nine Tailors, I would say, even though she's not a ringer herself, knows a heck of a lot more about the construction of methods than I do. Right. So I can remember the order that my bell takes.
Right. Among, so you remember the shape?
I do. That's exactly
that's
what
I do. That's how I do it, too. Yeah.
Where did you ring?
Radley and in Oxfordshire.
Yeah, I was going to say in Oxford. Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, that's where we started out as teenagers, and that's where a bell took the skin off my hand, and I was like, okay, enough of this for me.
Do you know, it was very scary. I remember being scared of it when I first started doing it. If I just do this long enough, I'm going to stop being scared of it. And that did, in fact, happen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you fly planes, so.
I know. I haven't quite stopped being scared of that. Mm-hmm. I confess, I keep thinking, you know, this has got to be like change ringing. Eventually, it will become rote, but it hasn't yet.
Yeah, well, I think I'm glad of that, because if things become too rote, then you don't.
No, that is true. That's true of flying, actually. I think the greater number of accidents happen at a certain point in your piloting career where you start to kind of take it for granted that you know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. I haven't reached that point. If I have an accident, it'll be because I'm incompetent, not because I've started being blasé.
What I wanted to ask was about research again. Were you able to actually speak to anyone who did this kind of work? Did you do research of that kind also?
Right, which brought me actually to a question of mine. I wanted to ask about some particular real people, because we have some beautiful photos that you've sent us from the Imperial War Museum. Yeah. And I know that one of them depicts a woman that you named, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about those people. And also the people that you mention as influences, like Arlene Huss and James Allen. Would they mind if you talk about them?
I don't think so. No, Arlene Huss is a good friend of my grandmother's, and I should probably add in here that my grandmother is 96. She's a bit younger than my grandmother. Mm-hmm. So probably a coworker. She came over with a unit from the U.S. in 1945, and she was doing some kind of auxiliary work for the U.S. Army or Air Force. Mm-hmm. And she vetted my original short story, mainly for rumors about food and stuff like that. But yeah, she is one of my reading fans. So I always feel like if I've got Arlene's stamp of approval, it's probably going well. James Allen is a member of the Scottish Era Club, and he's their historian, basically. He was very young. He wasn't actually involved in the war. He learned to fly just after the war. But I would guess that his learning curve was quite similar. You know, he trained on the Sinclair aircraft and tiger moths. There was also a fellow at the Scottish Aero Club when I was on the executive committee there who had actually flown during the war. And he was one of the men, if not the single man responsible for the sinking of the Bismarck, which was done in this, you know, ridiculous old-fashioned biplane called a Swordfish. And he was this very unassuming person, very jolly guy, and he was always being dragged off to these BBC documentaries on raising the Bismarck and his exciting piloting youth. And he was still flying well into his 80s. He was stationed on the aircraft carrier Ark Royal in the Mediterranean, and so his registration on his little plane was Gulf Ark. So, yeah, he was a very interesting guy. And the other person that I always mention when people ask me about the real people involved in this kind of thing is my French teacher in high school who was in the French Resistance.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Yeah, she was a really amazing woman. I tried very hard to kind of leave her stories out of Codename Verity for a number of reasons, but she certainly was a huge influence on me. And I maintained communication with her till she died in her 80s and took my kids to meet her. She was just a really, really inspiring voice in my life. Her name was Annette Berman. But as far as actual special operations executive and agents are concerned, no, I have not spoken to any. I have not interviewed any air transport auxiliary pilots, but I have actually met them. I went to a symposium a couple years ago where there was a panel of former ATA pilots talking about their experiences, and they were all, I think, pretty well close to their 90s, if not actually in them at that point. And they were amazingly inspiring women as well, and very articulate speakers too. A couple of them had gone on to do piloting or air industry related jobs in later life, and some of them hadn't. Some of them just stopped flying after the war. So,
wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, thank you.
Always when I read, I'm connecting with other books in my mind as well as with the book I'm reading. And one thing that your book really made me think of, there's a character in Muriel Spark's Loitering with Intent, and she says that no artist has ever lived who has not experienced and then recognized something at first too incredibly evil to be real, and then so undoubtedly real as to be undoubtedly true. And I was thinking that a lot of artists are in some sense engaging with evil or trying to promote good. Your book in particular is a response of love to an incredibly evil situation. Would you say that that is the impulse for your art?
Yeah, I suppose in a sense it is. I think, you know, many other artists and writers really questioned what on earth I was doing after the September 11th attacks. And it just, you know, what on earth am I providing to the world here? You know, could I not be doing some better service? And it changed a lot the course of The Lion Hunter, which I was working on at the time. And that became a book about fear. And I don't know if I've made it up myself or if I've seen it other places, but the opposite of fear is love. That was what I really took away out of the September 11th attacks, where everybody's final words to each other were, "I love you." And that, I feel, was very, very important to me to get across to other people. When I'm writing, I'm not thinking about it so much, I'm thinking about telling the story. But if there is any kind of theme that runs throughout my books, I think it is taking responsibility. So there's also this sense of you have the potential to do evil within you. Mm-hmm. And my characters are always grappling with this. You have the potential to harm. And this is actually something, even before I kind of became aware of the potential to do evil, I was woken up to the potential to harm when a friend of mine ran over someone and killed someone. when I was about 20. And, you know, at that point in my life, I had been really focused on how wonderful it would be if I was able to save someone's life. And that was like what I really wanted to be able to do. Then I would have made my mark on the world if I'd saved someone's life. And it had never, ever occurred to me, you could actually take away someone's life and you might not even be doing it on purpose. So that was kind of an eye-opener. And I guess what I really do try to do in my books all the time is to get people, A, to be aware that that potential is there, either consciously or unconsciously, and B, to get people to take responsibility for their own actions. My children are so fed up with hearing me say, take responsibility for your own actions, that quote me. They'll beat me to the punch and say it first. I really do think that that's really important, you know, to be aware that this potential is within us all. And it's not just based on you, you know, outside forces can force your hand. And once that's happened, again, you have to be aware of the role that you played in it. So, yes, although it has not influenced me directly, I have actually come across people that I feel are really probably evil. And obviously, I have seen throughout my lifetime evil at work. So, yeah, I feel like I'm playing maybe a small part in the battle against it. Certainly not as large a part as that other generation did.
Well, still, we think your book is so marvelous and will be inspiring to, I hope, a lot of people. Did you have another question, Mary?
I was thinking that this brought me back to my very first question about your inspiration for your characters, because one of the things that I loved about The Winter Prince is that it is told from the point of view of the archer, who is, in many of the myths, stereotyped as evil. Mm. And he's, in fact, not evil. He's a human being. And everybody in that book, as you say, has a capacity for evil as well as a capacity for good. And that, to me, is just so great and so refreshing. It's a really, really important message. And I think you carry through with all your other stories.
Hey, thanks, Mary. And I just had then two more questions, if that's okay.
Okay.
Okay, great. First, I was thinking now of Codename Verity. The story arcs of some characters do come to a definite end, but there's others who are completely open-ended, like, say, Anna. And we're wondering, are you going to maybe show us more about those characters in another book? Is there a companion volume?
Yes. Yes, there is, and yes, I am.
Yay. Okay, and when can we... Well, we don't know, I guess, when we can look forward to that.
The date that people are bandying about is... I hate to say this because it sounds way too soon. August of next year. I would not be surprised if that is moved back. But the book is finished. So...
Wonderful. Okay, yeah. So we'll really look forward to reading it. Okay. That's great. The other thing I just wanted to ask, because I always do end my podcast this way, there are a lot of young people who do want to maybe make a difference in the world and perhaps be a writer or an artist. Mm-hmm. And what would your advice be to young people who want to do something creative like that?
Well, I'm just kind of blown away lately by how much opportunity there is out there because of the internet for young people now, stuff that just wasn't available to me when I was younger. So, you know, young people are already able to make their mark on the world. This young woman in Pakistan, for example, who's been keeping...
I was thinking of her.
Yeah, I say young woman, she's 14. Yeah, so she was asked by the BBC if she would blog about going to school, and so she does, and it has resulted in her being shot by the Taliban, which just seems, you know, I haven't words for it, really. That's kind of one extreme. On the other extreme, there's a young girl, a 9-year-old in Scotland, which is where I live, so she's, you know, relatively local, who was keeping a blog about her school dinners. She was basically just giving them ratings. She was writing reviews on them. Some of them she liked and some of them she didn't. And it turned into the council got a hold of this and got upset, and the BBC got hold of it, and it kind of went viral, this girl's, you know, school lunch blog. And the council decided, they actually had a turnaround, the council being like, you know, the local government. They had a turnaround and said, right, okay, we actually think she's doing a good service here and we're going to pay attention to what she says. And so on a very, very small scale, this girl is making her mark on the world. And she's only 9, and she's a bit older now. But I think that the internet is a fantastic vehicle for many, many different reasons for kids who are creative and dedicated to make their voices known right now. And as far as more traditional ways are concerned, if you want to be any kind of artist, any kind of writer, creative in any way, the thing to do, of course, is to be focused and to keep working at it, keep producing stuff. And also to have kind of a good sense of, I am unfinished. What I produce now at the age of 17 or whatever is not going to be the greatest work of my life. I certainly didn't realize that when I was 17. And I think my life would have been a lot easier if I had, because what I was producing was not the quality that I would have wanted it to be. And so it was frustrating. And I think, you know, people should be aware that you get better not only as you practice, but also as you just become more experienced in life and as you have more things to add to what you're doing. I could not have written Codename Verity 20 years ago. It's a product of my having been a mature writer. So I couldn't have written it when I was 12, and I didn't. But yeah, I would say practice, check out what other people are doing, and take advantage of the resources that are available. I also forgot to tell you anything about Pauline Gower, who you asked me about earlier.
Right. Uh-huh. So tell us about Pauline Gower, then.
She was the head of the women's section of the Air Transport Auxiliary. She is actually mentioned in Codename Verity. She's one of the few real people that I mention. Mm-hmm. And originally, she was an instructor, and she had her own business flying during the 30s. And she was appointed as the head of this section, and it was her job to pick the original women who would join the ATA late in 1939, early in 1940. And she basically just kept the whole thing running throughout the war. And she was a very persuasive, very diplomatic woman. She got involved with Jackie Cochran, who founded the Women's Air Service Pilots, the WASP, the American sort of version of the Air Transport Auxiliary. They weren't quite the same kind of organization. And before the WASP started, there were American women pilots who came to the UK to join the ATA. And the other thing that Pauline Gower pulled off really with aplomb was getting women to be allowed to fly operational aircraft. So fighter planes, bombers, larger planes with multiple engines, which everyone said, you know, oh, women are going to be, they're not going to be built to be able to manage these aircraft. They'll be too small, they'll be too weak. And of course, that's silly. It's not really anything to do with how big you are or how strong you are.
Right.
And she also got the women of the ATA on an equal pay scale. In 1943, they were the first organization in Britain to pay women the same wage as men for the same job. Yeah.
Good for her. That's
very
awesome.
Cool. She didn't live very long after the war. She died, I think, in childbirth, giving birth to twins within maybe the next 5 or 10 years, sadly.
But that is a great story. And I'm so glad that she's a real-life character in your book.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, thank you so, so much for talking to us today. This was really wonderful. And again, this was Elizabeth Wien. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you, everyone, for listening to this podcast. We have many more thanks to convey. Certainly, first, we need to thank Elizabeth Wien again, who not only spoke to us today, but also provided many of the images you have seen in this podcast, including the two portraits of herself with a Lysander plane in the famous Queenie sweater, the orange sweater, and also her epic World War II illustrations from when she was 12 years old. Finally, the Imperial War Museum in England licensed her for use in this podcast with three illustrations, one of a woman pilot of an Avro Anson, one of an ATA woman instructing a man in how to fly a plane, and one of Pauline Gower in a tiger moth. And you'll see those as chapter headings. All the other images you see are actually in the public domain. The one of Princesses Margaret and Elizabeth is from the Creative Commons and Flickr. And now about the music. Our opening song is by Kyle and the Iliad. The excerpt of Mendelssohn you heard was taken from a London Symphony Orchestra recording conducted by Sir George Scholte. And for our closing song today, we have a special treat for you. You're going to be hearing Anne Southern's 1941 rendition of Jerome Kern's The Last Time I Saw Paris. Maddie and Queenie would have been very familiar with this version, as well as with Kate Smith's. You can buy this track on iTunes or Amazon, or you can find it at your local library, along with all the rest of the music and the books that we have mentioned in this show, and the amazing novel Codename Verity by Elizabeth Wien. Again, we hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Please get in touch with us. Maria and I can be found at the Mount Kisco Public Library. Mary's at the North Castle Library in Northern Westchester. And we'd all love to hear your comments and reactions. Now, without further ado, here's Anne Southern. Enjoy.
The last time I saw Paris, her heart was warm and gay. I heard the laughter of her heart in every street cafe. The last time I saw Paris, her streets were dressed for spring, and lovers walked beneath those trees. Birds found songs to sing. I dodged the same old taxi cabs that I had dodged for years. The chorus of their squeaky horns was music to my ears. The last saw Paris, her heart was warm and gay. No matter how they change her, I'll remember her that way. I dodged the same old taxi cabs that I had dodged for years. The chorus of their squeaky horns was music to my ears. The last time I saw Paris, her heart was warm and gay.